We're looking at Lamb Rim today, stages of path enlightenment, the framework that is put together for how to follow the spiritual path in the Geluk school of Tibetan Buddhism. And we saw the first topic was relying on a teacher, and we saw there that if we really want to follow any tradition in depth, there are a lot of advantages to having a qualified teacher. Of course, now we can begin to do something without a qualified teacher, but at some point I think if we really want to be most effective in progressing in whatever we're doing, it would be very helpful to find a qualified teacher. The second topic in the Lamrim is precious human life. And this comes here to help us to reflect on our precious human life, to understand the precious opportunity we have. That we're not just human, but in fact, we're living in a time and place where we have so much easy access to so many spiritual traditions. In fact, for the very first time in our human history on this planet, do we have so much different spiritual traditions at our fingertips. We only have to go back 100 years or so to realize that wasn't the case. So we're very, very lucky to be living in a time and place where we have so much easy access to these things. And also, of course, we have the good conditions to be able to do that as well. The fact that you're all here means that you have certain good conditions that enable you to be actually here. And then also, of course, on top of that, we have some aspiration or wish to improve ourselves. So we have all of these good conditions in this human life. And unfortunately, we tend to take it for granted, you know. And often, in fact, it's worse than that. Not only do we take these good conditions for granted, we often complain about the fact that, you know, my coffee's not good enough in the morning, you know, it's not good enough quality or something, you know. We're sort of complaining about these things, you know, how bad things are because I can't have my Lavazza coffee, I have to have sort of an instant coffee instead, you know. So therefore, we really, often we don't appreciate something until we've lost it or about to lose it in general in our life. And so here, if we reflect on our precious human life, we'll really appreciate the precious opportunity we have. And we're not going to waste our life. Now, therefore, we'll want to make our life meaningful. So on the basis of this, hopefully we have this aspiration, I want to make my life as meaningful as possible. What can I do? Now the Lamrim sets out in three stages or levels what we can do to make our life meaningful. And these three stages or levels are in terms of our capacity. So at the sort of minimum level of how to make our life meaningful is to simply strive for a good future. And good future, of course, not only means a good future in this life, but of course, if we believe in rebirth, we're talking about good future lives. So then we have some topics here to help us at this level. And first, of course, we need to begin to develop the aspiration to strive for a good future. And so how do we develop the aspiration to strive for a good future? Is that often simply reflecting on precious human life can give us a sense that I want to make my life meaningful. But then often what can happen is, yes, I want to make my life meaningful, but now I'm busy, you know. I'm with my career and spirit, my career and family stuff, you know. that spiritual stuff I'll do later when I retire or something. And of course, we keep putting it off and off, and we never begin to do anything. So to help us to really have the aspiration to strive for a good future right now, we have the next topic, the next reflection. And that is to reflect on death and impermanence. To reflect on the fact that this precious human life is not going to last forever. Often we have the idea or sort of instinctively feel, you know, I'm going to live a long time, at least 80, 90 years, I think. I've got plenty of time. But actually, here in the text, the reflection is often described as what's called the 9-point death reflection or meditation. Sorry? Yeah, so, you know, even though we want to make our life meaningful, we often don't do anything now because we think, oh, I'll do it later. So this is going to help us to develop this aspiration now. We want to start to develop a good future or strive for a good future right now and not sort of delay it, put it off. And the way to help to do that is to appreciate we don't have unlimited time, you know, that we don't know how long we're going to live, so let's start right now. So often the way it's presented in the text is this 9-point reflection. And the 9 points are actually 3 main points, and each one has 3 things to think about. So the first main point is that death is certain. And within that, the 3 things that to reflect on, the first one is that death is unavoidable. Means everyone has to go through that process. The second point to reflect on here is that our life is, the amount of time left in our life is diminishing. Meaning we are every moment moving towards death. And the third point to reflect on here is that actually we have little time available. And the reflection there is to think that, you know, in each day, probably a third of it we're asleep, and then we have other things we have to do during the day. So if we cut out all of those, the amount of time we have to meditate and develop ourselves is actually quite small. So this is what to reflect on here, that death is certain, that it's unavoidable. We're constantly moving towards it, and we don't have much time. Then the second main of the 3 points to reflect on is that that the time of death is uncertain. Because often we feel, you know, I'm going to live a long time. But actually, how long we live, we don't know. And what to reflect on, the 3 points to reflect on here is, the first is to reflect on the fact that the human lifespan is variable. Meaning, some people die old, some not so old, some very young. That it's completely variable, the human lifespan. It's not like every human lives to be 80. So that's the first, that the lifespan is completely variable in the human situation. The second point to reflect on here is that there are many causes for premature death. There are many reasons we could die before old age. Accident, illness, natural catastrophe, war, disease, accident, many things. There can be many reasons that there can be premature death. And then the third point to reflect on here, and I think anyone in the medical field knows this very well, is that the body is fragile. You know, we think our body's very solid. But actually, it only can take one little tiny thing to go wrong and the whole body collapses. In fact, I think it's often, you know, probably from medical, if we study a body medically, it's like a miracle that it actually keeps functioning. And so that's what to reflect on here. So there's a question.
Yeah, if we believe in rebirth, doesn't that contradict this? We shouldn't care about that much, because, well, there's another life we can...
Ah. But the question is, are we having one of these types of lives in future? Are we guaranteed in the next life of having these good conditions that we have now? So what we're saying is that on the basis of the fact that we have very good conditions now, which may or may not be the case in the future, let's take advantage of that while we've got it, because we don't really know what's going to come in the future. Otherwise, of course, we could have this way of thinking, you know. And if our thinking was that we're always human or always better, then of course we'd be just lazy. We'd go, well, I don't care. You know, next life I'm going to have good conditions again and I can do it then. But that's not the case here. Is that if we waste this life, particularly if we engage in harmful behaviour, we're probably high likelihood we're not going to have this in our next life.
Very true. I mean, it seems equally as important, though, to remember that these practices are good for this life.
Yes.
I mean, it's not just about, to me, that seems somewhat, the good future is almost like an added benefit, but the real benefit is here and now.
Exactly. And if we don't do this, we may just waste our life and not have a good this life.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Right. But, and on that point, what we're going to come to here is how can we actually, because this is just developing the aspiration for a good future, then we need to actually do something to implement that. And what we're going to see here shortly, how we implement that is ethical lifestyle. So if we adopt an ethical lifestyle, then we'll end up moving in a good direction in this life. And then, whether or not we believe in rebirth, if there is rebirth, we've done the right thing. If there's no rebirth, we've done the right thing. Win-win. Win-win. Okay. The third point to reflect on here is what is helpful at the time of death? And here there are three things that are not going to help us at the time of death. And the first is our resources, all of our stuff, our money, our possessions. We have to leave it behind. We can't take that with us. Second, what's not helpful at the time of, or can't help us at the time of death, is our friends. Of course, approaching death, friends can be very helpful and supportive and comforting. But the actual time of death, we have to leave them behind. We have to go alone. And the third thing, probably our most precious possession, that's not going to help us at the time of death, is our body. We have to leave our body behind as well. So what is actually helpful at death is how much we have cultivated our mind in our life, in terms of positive overcoming negative. So that's what's going to be helpful at death, is how much we have developed our mind. So if we reflect on this 9 points, these three main points and 3 points here, then we'll appreciate that we have to go through death, we don't know when we're going to die, and we can appreciate what's really going to help us is how much we've developed our mind. Then that will lead us to developing the aspiration to strive for a good future right now. And then impermanence here, we looked at a bit before, and here with impermanence, we can talk about two levels of impermanence. We can talk about coarse impermanence and subtle impermanence. Coarse impermanence is something comes into existence, it hangs around a bit, goes out of existence. So, of course, the example of coarse impermanence here that to reflect on that is useful, of course, is death. The fact that our life will come to an end. Subtle impermanence, of course, is what we've already mentioned a number of times already. The fact that things are changing moment by moment. And I'd like to add a little bit to that on what we've said already. And often we have this idea that impermanence is bad news. And we often have this idea that we suffer because things change. But actually we suffer because we don't accept the law of change. It's a fact that things change moment by moment. We can either accept that fact or we can not want that to happen and suffer. Our choice. And here, the analogy that I often give is that our life is flowing. Ourselves and everything around us moving, constantly moving. So I use the analogy that we're in the middle of the river of life flowing past. And now what happens, of course, in the river of our life, when something nice flows past, we grab it or try to grab it and hold on to it. And of course, that takes a lot of effort, and often, of course, it will go eventually, and we'll just get frustrated and disappointed. And of course, it takes a lot of effort to try and hold on to these things. Whereas, so we're fighting against the flow of life by trying to hold on to things. So rather, if we can realize impermanence, we can, instead of fighting against the flow of life, we can work with the flow of life. So then rather than being the person trying to hold on, we'll be like a person in a little canoe with a paddle and paddling down the river of life, navigating our way down the river and enjoying the ride. So therefore, actually, if we realize impermanence, we can use it to our advantage. So actually, impermanence is good news. Because if things didn't change, couldn't change, we'd be stuck. We couldn't improve, we couldn't change. So on that note, I'd like to read a little bit again from the book by Songtsar Kyentse called What Makes You Not a Buddhist? And the section in the book is titled Impermanence is Good News. And he says the following. Buddha was not a pessimist or a doomsayer. He was a realist, while we tend to be escapists. When he stated that all assembled things are impermanent, he did not intend for that to be bad news. It is a simple scientific fact. Depending on your perspective and your understanding of this fact, it can become a gateway to inspiration and hope, glory and success. For example, to the extent that global warming and poverty are products of insatiable capitalistic conditions, these misfortunes can be reversed. This is thanks to the impermanent nature of assembled phenomena. Instead of depending on supernatural powers, such as God's will, to reverse such negative trends, a simple understanding of the nature of assembled phenomena is all that is needed. When you understand phenomena, you can manipulate them and thus affect causes and conditions. You might be surprised how much a small step, like just saying no to plastic bags, could postpone global warming. Recognizing the instability of causes and conditions leads us to understand our own power to transform obstacles and make the impossible possible. This is true in every area of life. If you don't have a Ferrari, you may very well create the conditions to have one. As long as there is a Ferrari, there is an opportunity for you to own one. Likewise, if you want to live longer, you can choose to stop smoking and exercise more. There is reasonable hope. Hopelessness, just like its opposite, blind hope, is a result of a belief in permanence. You can transform not only your physical world, but your emotional world. For example, turning agitation into peace of mind by letting go of ambition, or turning low self-respect into confidence by acting out of kindness and philanthropy. If we all condition ourselves to put our feet in other people's shoes, we will cultivate peace in our homes, with our neighbours, and with other countries. These are all examples of how we can affect assembled phenomena on a mundane level. Siddhartha also found that even the most feared levels of hell and damnation are impermanent, because they too are assembled. Hell does not exist as a permanent state somewhere underground where the damned suffer eternal torture. It is more like a nightmare. A dream in which an elephant tramples you comes about because of a number of conditions. First of all, sleep, and perhaps you have some negative history with elephants. It doesn't matter how long the nightmare lasts. During that time, you are in hell. Then, because of the causes and conditions of an alarm clock, or because you have simply finished sleeping, you wake up. The dream is a temporary hell, and it is not unlike our concepts of a real hell. Similarly, if you have hatred toward a person and engage in acts of aggression or revenge, that in itself is an experience of hell. Hatred, political manipulation, and revenge have caused hell on this earth. For example, when a young boy, shorter, thinner, and lighter than the AK-47 he carries, does not even have one day's opportunity to play or celebrate his birthday because he's too busy being a soldier. This is none other than hell. We have these kinds of hells because of causes and conditions, and therefore we can also exit these hells by using love and compassion as antidotes to anger and hatred, as Buddha prescribed. The concept of impermanence does not foretell Armageddon or the apocalypse, nor is it a punishment for our sins. It is not inherently negative or positive. It is simply part of the process of the compounding of things. We usually appreciate only half of this cycle of impermanence. We can accept birth but not death, accept gain but not loss, or the end of exams but not the beginning. True liberation comes from appreciating the whole cycle and not grasping onto those things that we find agreeable. By remembering the changeability and impermanence of causes and conditions, both positive and negative, we can use them to our advantage. Wealth, health, peace, and fame are just as temporary as their opposites. And of course, Siddhartha wasn't favouring heaven and heavenly experiences. They are equally impermanent. So I think that's some good advice. Okay. So then the first reflection here is death and impermanence. To help us to really develop this aspiration to strive for a good future right now. What could also be helpful to develop this aspiration is to reflect on possible future suffering. And that is to really reflect on the fact that if we are now engaging in harmful behaviour, then we're going to experience some sort of suffering experiences in the future. And therefore, we really don't want to have suffering in the future, so therefore we would want to develop the aspiration to actually strive for a good future. So this is going to help us to develop the aspiration, but then we need some method to actually achieve a good future. And here there are two topics listed in terms of the method. And the first topic is refuge. Because if we want to overcome suffering, if we want to find happiness, then we need to turn to something for refuge from suffering. We need to have something that's going to help us, to protect us and help us to overcome suffering. Now, of course, when we have suffering, often our refuge is not very effective and sometimes even harmful. Often now, of course, when we have some sort of suffering, often we don't know how to deal with it, so our refuge is simply distract ourselves, go and do something else, forget about it. And then sometimes, unfortunately, what we turn to actually can induce more suffering. Like, if we're suffering, we could turn to drugs and alcohol to numb the pain, but of course that brings a whole lot more problems. So therefore, we want a valid source of refuge. So here, who or what is a valid source of refuge to help us to overcome suffering and to find a good future? And here within Buddhism, when we talk about refuge, we talk about refuge in what's called the three jewels. And here, again, we have a similar analogy to the Four Noble Truths, that when we are sick, who or what do we turn to for refuge? Generally, we turn to the doctor for refuge from suffering, because we believe the doctor is qualified in not only diagnosing what our problem is, but hopefully solving it as well. So generally, we turn to the doctor. So here, the first three jewels is the Buddha. The Buddha is like our doctor. And we can turn to the Buddha because the Buddha is qualified, like the doctor. The Buddha is someone who has overcome all of their own suffering, so they know how to overcome suffering, so they can really help us. But then, of course, what actually protects us from suffering is the medicine. That's what helps us to overcome the suffering. So the second of the three jewels is the Dharma. The Dharma here, of course, is the teachings. So here, actually, Dharma, we can talk about two types of Dharma. We can talk about the Dharma of Scripture and the Dharma of Realization. And in the analogy, of course, the Dharma of Scripture is the actual physical teachings, the written teachings or verbal teachings. So in the analogy, that would be maybe like having the script for the medicine. And then the Dharma of Realization is how much we have internalized these ideas. So Dharma realization would be actually swallowing the medicine. So the thing that's going to protect us from the suffering is when we take the medicine. We can even have the best medicine in our hands, but if we don't swallow it, it won't help us. We can have the best teachings in the world in our hand. If we don't internalize that, it won't help us. If we just leave it as an intellectual. So what we can understand is that the real, actual refuge from suffering is this. To the extent that we have internalized it, to that extent we have protected and overcome suffering. To the extent we've actually taken the medicine. But then sometimes when we're sick, we may need to do an operation. And then we need to slowly recover in the hospital. And then who helps us there is, of course, the nurses. So the third jewel is called Sangha. Sangha is spiritual community. It's those people around us who help us to implement the Dharma. And this is something I tend to emphasize more and more and more, and I'm going to talk more about this on the last morning of the course. And this is something very important. And I know from personal experience, if we want to follow any sort of spiritual life, more meaningful life, and we try to do it on our own when we go home, I think we're going to find it almost impossible. Because we have quite strong habits already that are pushing us in a direction we don't want to go, and we have so much influences around us that also are pushing us in the opposite direction. So I think if we want to implement something when we go home to move our life in a new, better direction, we need Sangha. We need other people, like-minded people. We need to connect with them. We need to support them and get support from them. In my own personal experience, I came into contact with Buddhism, of course, right here, and then also in Kathmandu. I went back to Australia full of enthusiasm, wanted to really change my life. Where I went back to, there was no Buddhist centres at the time, no one interested in doing any of this sort of stuff, so I was on my own. And even though I wanted to meditate and change my life, for 2 years, nothing happened. Nothing. Because I just got swept up in my old habits. And so I think this is a challenge that many of us are going to face. And so if we have the attitude, I'm going to do it on my own, I think most of us, it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible. So if we really want to move our life in a better direction, we need Sangha. Whether that's in the form of an organized Buddhist center or some organized group, or just a couple of people coming together, it's not important. Important is to get associated with other like-minded people, gather together regularly, support each other. Otherwise, we'll feel I'm in this on my own and we're just going to give up and get swept away. Unless, of course, some very strong-minded people, even as a beginner, can manage to move forward in that direction. But I wasn't one of those, and many people I talk to also have this very strong difficulty that they often find that it's almost impossible to change because of our strong habits and all the influences around us. So we need some protection, some support. So this is the three jewels, and this is who or what we can turn to for refuge here. Now, on that point, we can talk about doing what's called a refuge ceremony. And that usually is what is defined, what it means to be a Buddhist. And we can do this sort of formal ceremony where we go through the ceremony and we make a formal commitment. We say, I believe in my life that I believe that this is the direction I want to follow my life, and I believe that the Buddha's teachings and that spiritual community can help me in my life, and I want to follow that direction. So we make that formal commitment. And generally it's said that when we do that refuge ceremony, we become Buddhist. But here, and there is a reason, there is a good reason to do the ceremony. And that is a little bit like in our life, if we have a partner and we want to make a formal commitment to them, often we go through the marriage ceremony. Because in the marriage ceremony, we're making that formal commitment. If we don't do that, then what's more likely to happen, of course, is if some difficult times come, it's more likely, oh, this is too difficult, see you later, I'm out of here. Rather, if we've done the marriage ceremony and we've made that formal commitment, we're more likely to work through those difficult times rather than just give up. Similarly here, if we've made that formal commitment, we're probably more likely to work through it rather than just, oh, things are too difficult, I give up. So now, with this refuge ceremony, then we can become what's called Buddhist. But here we need to be very careful. And often then people do this refuge ceremony and then they go, I'm a Buddhist. And then they go home and they tell everyone, I'm a Buddhist. You know, maybe even stick a little label on their head, I'm a Buddhist. And then you look at what they're doing with their life. Are they really trying to implement this? Not really. But they're happy now because they're a Buddhist. You know, I'm a Buddhist. You know, I'm a spiritual person now. And so then we can delude ourselves. So we need to be careful that we don't, and this can happen very easily, is that one way of saying it is that, of course, in this spiritual path, we're trying to transcend the ego. But of course, the ego doesn't want to die. So when the ego feels threatened, the ego hijacks. So then often what happens is the ego hijacks our spiritual practice and then we become spiritual ego. You know? And then often what we see sometimes is, you know, then people done the refuge ceremony. Okay, next, shave my head. Next, wear some funky Buddhist clothing, nice Buddhist jewelry, and go around telling everyone how spiritual I am. Spiritual ego. Ego's completely hijacked us, and spiritual ego is one of the worst because spiritual ego usually has a sense of superiority. You know, I'm spiritual, are you? You know? So we don't want to go there. So remember, if we do the refuge ceremony, it's really to make this inner commitment to ourselves and not make a big outward display of it. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that on the last morning. Now, with this, of course, then we are making a formal commitment that we want to follow the Buddhist spiritual path. And what we see then is that we can follow this Buddhist spiritual path at these three levels. At the Foundation Four Noble Truths level, at the Mahayana level, and at the Vajrayana or Tantra level. To help us in each one of those three levels, there are what's called vows or precepts. And at the foundation level, where we are striving for nirvana, we have what's called the Pratimoksha vows. Moksha is liberation. Prati here means individual. So we are striving for our individual liberation from samsara. So with the Pratimoksha vows, as a lay person, we can take five vows or precepts, which are not killing, not stealing, no sexual misconduct, no lying, and no intoxicants are the five vows we can take. As a monk or a nun, they take hundreds of these. They have a huge list of these sorts of vows on what they should not do and what they should do. But as a lay person, generally we have those list of five. Not killing, not stealing, no sexual misconduct, no lying, no intoxicants. The no intoxicants, of course, is not saying that drinking alcohol is a non-virtue. What it's saying is that, of course, often what the case is, when we drink a bit of alcohol, we end up more, and we get maybe drunk, and then we start to do unethical behaviour. So for that reason. So they're the five vows or precepts here we can take. And then at the next level of practice, in the Mahayana, we can take what's called the Bodhisattva vows, and here there's quite a large list to help us, to support us in helping us to develop bodhicitta, and these are to help and support us in practicing the six perfections: generosity, ethics, patience, joyous effort, concentration, wisdom. So we have quite a large list here of things to do and not do to help us support us in that practice. And then, of course, at the highest level of practice, we have the tantric vows. And then we have also, we have at the level of Mahayana, the Bodhisattva vows, we have what's called the eight Mahayana precepts. And this is eight precepts we can take for one day, generally from sunrise to sunrise. And this is something that we can take whenever we want. And the reason for doing that for a 24-hour period is to really sort of be very mindful about these precepts for that short time. Because, you know, we can take these vows and we take them for life, but then after a couple of days we've forgotten about them and we're not really paying attention to them in our life. But these eight Mahayana precepts, we only take them for 24 hours, and so then for 24 hours we can really be mindful of these precepts, and really it can help us to be more ethical. And as we're going to see, because I'm going to mention them now, some of them are helping us to really work with our craving and attachment. So these eight Mahayana precepts, the first five are the five pratimoksha vows, no killing, no stealing. But here when it comes to, instead of no sexual misconduct, we talk about no sexual activity. And then we have no lying and no intoxicants. So we have those five. And then we add three more that are particularly helpful for working with craving and attachment. One of the big things we have craving and attachment for, of course, is food. So part of this one-day precept is to only have one meal, generally before lunchtime. So it's going to help us to really notice our craving and attachment for food. And usually within that one meal, also with the craving and attachment, we mentioned, I think, briefly, also in that food, generally to not have any onions and garlic and food that gives too much stimulus. And often included in there is, not food, but related to that, is no cigarettes. And then we can see, you know, if we're a smoker, our craving and attachment for that 24-hour period. So that's one extra one. And then the other two, one is usually described as not sitting on high thrones or elevated positions. Again, to sort of have this, you know, craving and attachment for sort of being superior to others. So not to sit on any high thrones or things like that. And the other one is no singing, dancing and wearing jewellery. Again, to notice our craving and attachment for these things. So these are the eight Mahayana precepts that we can take whenever we want. And generally often people take them on these sort of specific days like full moon and special days and so forth. What we're going to do in this course is to give you the opportunity, if you want, to do this. And we're going to do this the day after tomorrow. So this is completely optional, because remember, it involves one meal.
When?
Day after tomorrow.
No,
lunchtime. So if you want to do it, and again it's completely optional, it means no breakfast. Of course you can have tea, you'll get lunch, and then actually as a little special treat in the evening, you get hot chocolate. And those of you who don't want to do these precepts don't get any hot chocolate in the evening. So, but for this, the cooks need to know how many people. So you don't have to decide now if you want to do this or not. But tomorrow afternoon after lunch, Renato, when he'll be leaving his meditation, he'll ask how many people want to do this to get the numbers for the kitchen. And then also maybe if you have any further questions, you can ask at that time. But what's going to happen on that following day is anyone who wants to do this, There's a little sort of ceremony thing you go through to sort of like to take this in the morning, and that's going to happen at 6 o'clock. So you'll need to get up a little bit earlier. If you don't want to do it, then it's normal procedure. You come for 6:45 meditation. Those of you who want to do will come here at 6 o'clock. Renato will lead you through the little ceremony. It takes 25-30 minutes, and then you'll have a 15-minute break and then back for the meditation. Any questions about that? And Renato can answer some more tomorrow.
The eight
Mahayana precepts is the Mahayana level. So again, here we're just doing it as a little taster for it, but often you'll find in Tibetan Buddhism people do this sort of thing regularly because it can be very helpful, particularly watching our craving and attachment.
Another question is, if one of the eight is to not sit, how high throne, why is the other one to chair so high?
Because it's out of respect from our side. Out of respect from our side. And often you find, like, when some important teacher, sometimes we get quite important teachers coming here and we put one of these thrones out for them, and then there's this sort of tug of war, you know, they're saying, no, 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 and they're trying to sit down, and then the people here are trying to, you know, so they don't really want to do that. But of course also, usually if they teach a big crowd, they need to sit elevated to see them anyway, and often what you'll see is that when they sit there, they often click their fingers at the beginning, and that's to really understand impermanence and to really develop this humility, you know, that I'm not sort of up here some great being, you know, to really see that things are impermanent and really try to be as humble as possible.
Because it seems like we are adding to their...
But someone at that level of practice, it's not affecting them. And usually in the Tibetan culture, they would only provide that for people who are already advanced. They wouldn't provide that for someone who's not. So yes, otherwise you could boost their ego.
I have one question regarding to the sexual point.
Yeah.
when you do the Mahayana level, it sounds like sexuality at all is not good.
No.
How is it?
You mean in the day precepts?
Yeah.
Or
24
hours. So again, the whole idea here.
Interested in general, how the Buddhistic view is it general not good because you're
No. We're talking sexual misconduct.
No, but Mahayana level is no sexual activity.
No. Only for the one day precept, and the purpose being to look at our craving and attachment for sex. Like the craving and attachment for food, which are the two main types of craving. So for one day, just to notice that. We're not saying sexual activity is bad. What we're saying is to notice craving for it, which creates problems. So for one day, let's look at our craving for food and sex and see what goes on in our mind, and then try to reduce that so that when we do engage in sexual activity, it's more healthy.
But monks or nuns who do the Mahayana precept, they do it for more than one day.
No. The monks and nuns is this. Vows here.
Uh-huh.
It's in the Pratimoksha vows where monks and nuns, as one of their vows, is celibacy. It's here. And that is a choice. And part of becoming a monk or nun is to, and we pick the vehicle we want. We're not saying that being a monk or nun is superior or necessary. You know, often people feel like if I'm serious about this Buddhist path, I have to become a monk or a nun. Absolutely not true. Historically, there was some truth in that, because in ancient India and Tibet, if you weren't a monk or a nun, you had no opportunity. You were struggling to survive. You had no access to anything. The only way in those ancient cultures you had access to anything is if you became a monk or a nun. Then you'd have a place in the monastery or nunnery. You'd be roof over your head. You'd be fed. You'd be educated. You'd have access. Modern society, that's not the case. Because those monasteries and nunneries in those cultures were supported financially by the community. There's no such culture in our modern society. So if you want to be a monk or a nun in the modern countries, the non-Buddhist traditional countries, generally there's no monastery or nunnery you can go to, and even if there is, you're probably going to have to pay because they're not financed by anyone. So it's quite difficult to be monk or nun. But you can be monk or nun, and some people find that direction is useful. So we as an individual choose which path works best for us. And we may decide that the best approach for me is to be a monk or a nun. And in that approach, one of the parts of that approach is celibacy. Because it can be helpful to give some space from all this craving and attachment so that we can work on our mind. But it's an option, it's a choice. You know, we don't have to
but
go...
It's not that the Buddhism says sexuality is bad at all.
No.
It's just a craving.
Well, the craving can lead to sexual misconduct by cheating on our partner, by forcing ourselves on someone. This is what craving can do. So that's what we want to get rid of.
Since all of this is under trying to make your life as meaningful as possible, right?
Right. But, of course, this... What I'm talking about here is actually at the next levels.
Okay. I was just wondering, in general, how Buddhism treats like tradition, like Vedic astrology and stuff like that, in the sense of trying to understand which path is best for you, or like consulting, because Vedic astrology is part of the philosophy, not the Buddhist philosophy, but it's a way of consulting someone like, regarding what is best for you.
In terms of your vehicle. Yeah, and that's why we can have a teacher, or we can have Sangha who can give us advice.
Astrology is different, like going to someone to consult with in the sense of when you were born and stuff like that.
Oh, because astrology in general?
Vedic astrology is something a little bit different in the Hindu tradition.
Yeah.
It's considered a little bit more conservative, not like I see your future.
I don't know. I mean, of course, in Tibetan culture they have astrology and that, but in the Slam Rim you won't see any reference to astrology.
So Buddhism doesn't treat astrology in general like as a...
I mean, when we look at... when we talk about wisdom, we can talk about conventional wisdom and we can talk about learning wisdom in certain areas, in the arts and so forth, and one of those is astrology, so, you know, you can study it. But it doesn't really come anywhere here. Okay. No. apart from they're extremely difficult to sustain. Like I said the other day, is in the level of Tantra, if you give up love for even one single sentient being, this is considered a serious ethical downfall in Tantra. Serious.
So it's probably something like
to love with. Well, I mean, built in there. Because the thing is, at that level, we are doing the perspective from the fully enlightened state. Meaning, any little thing is a huge diversion from that. So it's extremely difficult to follow tantric vows. Extremely difficult. Okay. Then the next topic here is karma. And again, through reflecting on this, we can understand that harmful behaviour leads to suffering, virtuous behaviour leads to happiness. And we saw the other day in this presentation, the presentation of the 10 virtues. So then the method to achieve a good future is to adopt an ethical lifestyle. So that's the first level of making our life meaningful. It's basically adopting an ethical lifestyle. But then we can understand that if we adopt an ethical lifestyle, not only will that lead us to a good future in this life, but that will go a long way to ensuring continuing to have a good future in future lives. We can understand that we're still stuck in samsara. So then we can make our life meaningful at the next level, and that is to not only wish for a good future, but to develop the aspiration to break free of samsara altogether. So someone of middling capacity would then go on to striving for the goal of nirvana. So again here, to begin, we have to develop the aspiration for nirvana. And so how to develop the aspiration for nirvana, of course, is we need to reflect on the first two noble truths. To understand dukkha, the state we're in, and the fact that it's coming from our mental afflictions. And similar to that, we briefly touched on in that Wheel of Life chart, those 12 links, those 12 diagrams around the outside, they also, if we study them and look at them, they also help us to appreciate how we are stuck in samsara and how to break free. So we can also here reflect on the 12 links. And by reflecting on these first two noble truths and the 12 links, we will understand that we're stuck in samsara and we'll understand how to break free of it. And then, through that, we'll be able to develop the aspiration for nirvana, which of course is renunciation. So then, by doing these reflections, that will help us to develop this aspiration of renunciation, this aspiration for liberation. But then, of course, we need a method to actually achieve nirvana. And so, of course, the method to achieve nirvana were these Noble Eightfold Path, which we can condense into the three higher trainings. So then we have a description of the three higher trainings of ethics, concentration, and wisdom, particularly the wisdom of no self. There was a question here.
About the 12 links?
Yeah.
If you can repeat, I looked at it again and I, sure. Just from grasping to becoming to birth, I don't understand that.
Right.
Like I understand all the others.
Right. So this grasping is a particular grasping. It's a grasping that occurs at the time of death. When we're going through the death process, we are grasping to life itself. Mm. We are craving and grasping to life itself, and that craving and grasping to life during the death process causes a karmic imprint to be activated, which is the pregnant woman becoming.
Becoming.
So it's an activated imprint to determine the next life. That's the connection.
Grasping is before
the
pregnancy?
Yeah, so we're actually grasping, and that causes the imprint to be activated. So these are the reflections, the 12 links and the two first noble truths to help us develop the renunciation. And then to the method to actually achieve nirvana, of course, is the three higher trainings. So that's someone of middling capacity. Then we understand that we're not the only ones stuck in samsara. Everyone else is stuck in samsara as well. So then we can develop our motivation. We can expand more, not only wishing ourselves to be free of samsara, but wishing everyone to be free of samsara. So this, of course, then is someone of great capacity, the third level in making our life meaningful. So then someone of great capacity is striving for the goal of enlightenment. Sorry. So of course, first we need to develop the aspiration to strive for nirvana, for enlightenment. And so, of course, that aspiration is bodhicitta. And so then in the Lamb Rim, we have two topics of how to cultivate bodhicitta. And remember, the two methods described how to cultivate bodhicitta were these seven cause and effect and this equalizing and exchanging self with others that we briefly looked at the other day. And so through these methods we can cultivate bodhicitta, we can develop this aspiration for enlightenment, but then of course we need a method to actually achieve enlightenment. And so here in the Lamb Rim, of course, the method is the six perfections. So then in the Lamb Rim texts here, we would have detailed description of each of the six perfections and how to practice them. Generosity, ethics, patience, joyous effort, concentration, wisdom. And then of course, we can, at this level of practice then, we can understand that If we enter into Tantra or Vajrayana, we can accelerate the whole process by gaining access to the very subtle mind. So then right at the end of the Lamb Rim texts, there will be a mention about Tantra or Vajrayana. And remember, the practices there are these two stages, generation stage, completion stage. But of course, in the actual Lamb Rim texts, you will not see any description about these tantric practices, because these are only received in private from your personal teacher when you're ready to receive them. So this is the someone of great capacity. So this is basically the framework for Lamb Rim, how we can make our life meaningful at those three stages or levels. First, striving for a good future. On that basis, striving for liberation, nirvana, and then on that basis, striving for enlightenment. Any questions about any of these things here? Ethics, concentration, wisdom, or in Sanskrit, Shila, Samadhi, Prajna. And the wisdom there is this wisdom of no self, particularly.
So in the 9-point reflection...
On death?
On death.
Yeah.
You mentioned that time is uncertain.
Correct.
And that is, from our perspective, from our perspective, time is uncertain.
The time's uncertain. We don't know how long we're going to live.
Right.
And it will what?
It believes in fate, karma.
Karma is fate?
It in a sense,
no.
Fate.
No.
So
karma is not fate. Remember, when we talked about karma, we talked about the whole idea of purification, meaning we can affect karma. If we couldn't affect karma in any way, you could maybe have a case for saying that karma is fate. But because we can affect karma, and that's in our control, there's no such thing as fate.
Why? But you need faith to affect karma.
No, fate. Not fate. Faith.
Ah.
Fate.
Okay.
I think you're talking fate, yeah? F-A-T-E.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, fate, not fate. But remember, even if we do something bad, That doesn't necessarily mean we're going to experience a result. It depends what we do next. If we go through the whole purification practice by regretting what we did, doing a remedy, make a strong determination not to do it again, this can purify it to the point where we will not experience any result of that action. So we need to keep that in mind. Believe in?
I don't know the English term for it. Kaliyug, this era, that's presently the era.
Oh, different eras, yes. We also, in Buddhist cosmology, which I very vaguely touched on, is that Buddhist cosmology, the theory is a little bit similar to the multiple Big Bang theory, more or less. In a rough way, is that the universe goes through certain stages of formation, stability, dissolution, and it keeps cycling in this way. And of course, we can talk about multiple parallel universes as well. And then we can talk about certain, in terms of, that's at the physical level, but then of course we can talk about in terms of these sort of teachings being available and so forth. And then we can talk about different eras where they're available and not available and so forth as well within that.
So a person who would be born could be born into some different universe.
Sure, yes.
So it doesn't have to be.
No.
Can you say what's the difference between the generation stage and the completion stage?
Yeah. Remember, whole Tantra or Vajrayana is what's called the resultant vehicle, meaning we are doing the whole practice from the perspective of the enlightened state. Meaning, if we want to actually do that properly, we need to have an understanding and experience of emptiness. Otherwise, it's delusional. Otherwise, I'm pretending to be enlightened. And that's not the practice. But if we can do the practice well, then from a perspective of emptiness and a rise in the enlightened form, then generation stage often involves doing a sadhana, a practice manual, where you arise in the enlightened form and you do various things, often involves various visualizations, maybe chanting mantras and other activities. And generation stage then, at a deeper level, involves developing a high level of focus. So at a deeper level, generation stage practice is a little bit shamatha practice. And then completion stage practice is about causing the very subtle mind to become manifest. And we do that by withdrawing all the subtle energies into the central channel and causing all the subtle energies to come to the heart chakra. And the whole purpose of that, of course, is to cause the very subtle mind to become active, so that we can use that to realize emptiness, the nature of reality. So it's subtle body work, but it's really vipassana practice, because we want, in completion stage, to activate the very subtle mind to realize nature of reality. So we could say it's sort of a vipassana practice.
So you would reach high levels of jhana?
No, that's in shamatha. Jhana is concentration. So in generation stage practice, you'd be developing high levels of jhana. Any other questions? Okay. One more topic. We talked about that normally the measure of becoming a Buddhist is if we do this refuge ceremony, that we make a formal commitment. I believe that this is the way I want to follow my life. I want to rely on the Buddha, his teachings, and the community. But we can also talk about being Buddhist in terms of our philosophical view. Because this, in terms of the refuge ceremony, is really in terms of being a Buddhist by conduct. But in terms of philosophical view, we can also talk about being a Buddhist in terms of our philosophical view. For that, we can talk about what's called the four seals.
down in the book, right?
Not sure. Maybe not. The four seals are four statements that if we accept them, we can be considered to be Buddhist in terms of our philosophical view. And these four seals are the basis of this book I've read from a couple of times, What Makes You Not a Buddhist, is about these four seals. So what makes you not a Buddhist is if you don't accept these four statements. That's what he's saying in the book. And so sort of conversely meaning, if you do accept these four statements, you can be called a Buddhist, at least in terms of your philosophical view. So the first statement is, all compounded things are impermanent. And of course, impermanent here means changing moment by moment. And a compounded thing is anything created through causes and conditions. So anything created with causes and conditions, the Buddhist assertion is necessarily changing moment by moment. Meaning there are no things that are created by causes and conditions that are static and unchanging.
So what would be the example of an uncompounded?
An uncompounded thing is things that come into existence not depending on causes and conditions.
So like,
and the classic that's often used is emptiness. Emptiness, yes.
Energy?
No, energy is created through causes and conditions. The second statement is, all contaminated things are suffering. And here the word suffering is dukkha, means dukkha. Contaminated here means contaminated by the mental afflictions. So when we say all contaminated things, we're basically saying all our experiences are dukkha. So that's just basically the first noble truth. Contaminated here means the mind contaminated by the mental afflictions. So a contaminated thing is we're talking about contaminated experience, an experience coming through mental afflictions. The third statement is, all phenomena are empty and selfless. And here, the word empty and selfless is interpreted a little bit differently in those different Buddhist philosophical schools. You know, we briefly touched on yesterday that there is what's called Vaibhashika, Sautrantika, Chittamatra, and Madhyamika. Different philosophical systems in Buddhism. And they interpret these words differently, but they all agree all phenomena are empty and selfless.
It's the opposite of the other one, but the other side is the first thing?
No. In fact, impermanence, this is something I haven't mentioned, but it can be helpful. Remember, impermanence doesn't mean we have something in the present moment, and in the next moment it becomes something else, and then like this. Impermanence is constant change. If we can actually realize this, we're very close to realizing emptiness. Very close. Because if it's like this, constant change, then how can there be anything existing from its own side?
There's nothing stable. It's empty of stableness.
Yeah.
It's constantly changing.
So, again, it, where is
it? Whatever it is.
So when we say it is constantly changing, we usually have this idea. Here's an it that in the next moment changes. Another it changes. But this is not impermanence. This is impermanence. So to even say it is a bit misleading. So if we can appreciate this, we're very close to realizing emptiness. Very close. Not the same, but very close. Okay, fourth one. The fourth statement is nirvana is peace. And here the word peace means pacification. It's a state completely free of all suffering and its causes. That's what the word peace means here. So if we accept those four philosophical statements, we can be said to be Buddhist, at least in terms of our philosophical view. So that's the four seals. Any questions about that before we finish this morning? And unfortunately, that's why sometimes people give up on compassion. Because they see heavy suffering, they want to be compassionate, but they get overwhelmed. And they feel it's my compassion that's causing my overwhelm. Compassion can never cause overwhelm. What causes overwhelm is our aversion to that suffering. If we get rid of the aversion, compassion will never cause us to feel overwhelmed. And unfortunately, that's what people interpret. You know, they're very compassionate. They go out and try and help in the world, and they see suffering, 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 more, and they get overwhelmed. And then they often feel the reason they're overwhelmed is they've got too much compassion. So they cut it. They cut it.
Well, the reason they're suffering is from too much.
Yeah, and so they cut it, and then they just give up. And they say, well, this compassion didn't work because I just get overwhelmed. Compassion doesn't overwhelm. It's our aversion to the suffering that's overwhelming us. And that's coming from the me attitude, the self-grasping, self-cherishing. I don't like to see that. So if we can work on the wisdom side, if we can reduce our self-cherishing, self-grasping, you'll find your aversion to suffering will be less. In fact, there's a very nice little saying, I can't remember who said it, but about this whole idea of seeing suffering in the spiritual path. And this person said, now, of course, at our stage, we, to not get overwhelmed, we step back, we cut. You know, so we don't really experience fully because we get overwhelmed because of our aversion. And this person said, and I agree with him, he said, as we progress on the spiritual path, in terms of suffering, we'll feel it more and it'll bother us less. Because when we progress, we won't be sort of like, oh. We'll actually be more and more and more present, more and more in tune, and less overwhelmed because we're not having the aversion, the self-grasping. But we need to, of course, as a beginner, protect ourselves because we know as a beginner we have this strong aversion, so there's no point in going into too much suffering because we can't deal with it. So short-term strategy is to give ourselves a little bit of space. We're not running away. We're just giving ourselves a little bit of space so that we don't get overwhelmed, so we can work on ourselves, so that later we can go more and more and more into that situation without the overwhelm.
Just
feel it more and experience it
less? No, we'll feel it more and it'll bother us less. I like that saying. And I believe it's true, accurate.
There's also the recognition of the impermanence of the suffering itself and the...
And that can help as well.
...within even what we perceive as suffering
is much
more rich.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, yes, true, true. Last question, then we need to stop.
Philosophically, it means that you are in the theoretical way. Philosophical approach is not practicing, especially in map.
This is the Buddhist map.
Yes. And if you are in the philosophical way, you are only specialized in the theoretical approach or practical way of.
Yeah, I mean, of course, we can be a Buddhist philosopher, and there are people who are Buddhist philosophers, but being a Buddhist philosopher is not going to help us to overcome our suffering. You know, we can have the best, most detailed map in the world and be completely miserable. Completely miserable. So unless we grab our map and use it to navigate the territory, nothing's going to change. We're not going to improve. So therefore, we need a map, because if we don't have a map and we jump in the territory, we get confused and lost and go round and round and round and get nowhere. If we have a map, we jump in the territory, we can progress. So we need both. We need study and practice. We need theory and meditation, both together.
But why you separate the philosophical way?
No, I'm not separating. I'm just saying, in terms of whatever map we develop, if our map agrees with that, then we can say, at least at the philosophical level, we are in agreement with Buddhism. That's all. Okay. Let's stop there. Discussion questions. First question about these Lam Rim practices that we looked at this morning. Can we engage in these Lam Rim practices without believing in rebirth? Can we engage in these Lam Rim practices without believing in rebirth? Second question is about the first topic we looked at this morning, the relying on a teacher. And the question is, do we really need a teacher? Do we really need a teacher? If so, how should we rely on them? If so, how should we rely on them? Third question is about the topic of death and impermanence. The question is, how can reflecting on impermanence help us in our daily life? How can reflecting on impermanence help us in our daily life? Second part of the third question. Won't reflecting on death just make us depressed or anxious? Won't reflecting on death just make us depressed or anxious?